Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, October 29, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're giving you a peek at the technology behind electronic voting. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks, John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, and Miles Elam, Java programmer, web developer, and student of American literature. John, before we start with our talking with our guest from IEEE magazine, Stephen Cherry, about electronic voting, let's get a little bit of geek news. John, I'm going to start with you.
Hello, sir.
Hey,
now I can have news. Good morning, everybody. This week, Apple announced an update to their ever-popular iPod. The iPod Photo. The iPod Photo allows you to bring photographs over to the iPod and share them.
Okay, the iPod's a music player, an MP3 player.
No.
Not anymore.
The iPod is becoming Apple's version of a PDA, since Apple had the Newton way back when, in the 90s, and has since not had a PDA since they dropped Newton production. The iPod has kind of taken that, as well as being a good music player, it's also taken on a lot of other things. You can have your calendar on, you can have contacts. So now Apple has made it so you can, well, on the new one, put photos on it as well. So naturally, since you're putting photographs on the iPod, you don't want to look at them in grayscale. So they included a color screen as well. It's a 2-inch LCD color screen that can display 56,000 colors.
And this thing's more expensive than the old iPod. Too expensive.
It's a couple hundred dollars more.
So the idea being that you can be on the road and sharing your photos with this little LCD screen, is there another kind of output for it?
It has an AV output, so you can hook it up to a television. And on the fly, you can make slideshows with music. So you can look at your music library you have in your iPod, look at your photo library you have in your iPod, put together a slideshow with some music, and hook it up to a TV and display it. That's kind of cool.
That's pretty cool. Okay, but You talked about the Newton first because that was Apple's first attempt at a personal digital assistant.
Right.
This isn't really a personal digital assistant. It's more like a personal media.
It is more of a personal media.
Although, you got your music, you got your photos. Can you do like your contact information, your calendar, and address book?
It has that built into it. And other people have gone a couple steps further to be including things like there's Wi-Pod. It gives you all the local hotspots for wireless access. People have been making other things that'll go into. There's a notes section of the iPod. And people have been using that for a lot of different things. The third-party developer community has really been pushing the iPod into the PDA slot since it seems to be such a great form size for it.
Right. Okay, so it's kind of fitting that way, but Apple didn't design it intentionally that way. They designed it as a really good MP3 player.
Right.
Okay, you have one of the first revs of the iPod. Do you like it, and would you consider getting this new expensive photo one?
I don't really need to carry photographs around with me. I have a laptop. So if I want to pull out my digital wallet to show people, you know, there it is. However, that said, if I was in the market for a new iPod, I would consider this one.
Mm-hmm.
The price is a bit steep for me, though.
Okay.
So I probably would not get it.
It's interesting you mentioned the Newton. Last Wednesday, part of my job is to oversee the technology behind a MFA program at UCSC. And in that, we went to a field trip to the Computer Tech Museum in Mountain View, and they had a Newton, and it was such a kick to see that one of the first PDAs. The big failure, of course, with Newton is they tried to do complete handwriting recognition, and the software just wasn't there.
And the processing power wasn't there to handle it yet either.
Right. Yeah. So When we first saw a Palm device after the Newton that actually had the pseudo handwritten recognition, it made a lot of sense.
The way Apple tried to do it was, of course, make the machine conform to the person so that it would try to learn your handwriting style. The way Palm did it was have the person conform to the machine. They give you this language called graffiti. You write your letters this way, and the machine can recognize that.
Right.
So that was much more successful because at the time, yeah, like you said, there was neither the software or the hardware to support really good handwriting recognition.
Right. Well, Miles has not shown his face yet, so we're going to go right back to you on another news story. And just yesterday, you were crowned the Space Geek from the Geeks here. Geek Speaks, so Space Geek, get some space news for us.
Yeah. Cassini, the probe that's out hovering around Saturn, did a flyby of Titan recently. Pictures it took... This is the first time we've had really good pictures of Titan. Titan's the largest moon of Saturn. It's a bit bigger than our moon. And it's got a very dense atmosphere. And according to what spectral analysis we've been able to do so far, we believe it has a methane atmosphere. So they were able to penetrate that using infrared and radar and take a look at the surface. One of the things they found was a huge cloud spanning 620 miles at its widest over the South Pole. That's no surprise. They actually expected it to be there. They believe there's large lakes of liquid methane on the surface of Titan. What they didn't find, though, was methane in this cloud, which they couldn't figure out. So they believe that either A, it is methane, but the methane molecules have bonded to something else, so now their signature is different, or it could be something like ethane, which is a methane derivative, or
They're not sure what this cloud
is. They have no idea what it is.
Well, they should know perfectly what it is. If there's lakes of methane, they should know. Wait,
They think there's lakes of methane. Uh-huh. They don't know for sure. So they're looking forward to, you know, they still have a lot of data to go through. So none of this is conclusive. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of ideas, but none of them are you know, valid or based on any information. And the other thing they noticed is the topography was a little different than they thought. You know, most moons, most planets have a rough topography. They have mountains, you know, craters, lakes.
Right.
Titan's pretty flat.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of
depressing.
We're hoping to see some.
We're talking like Kansas flat. So they're trying to figure out why is this? Why do we not see shadows on the surface of Titan? That's one of the things that gives away height.
Right.
So a lot more research to be done. Everyone's really excited about this because the scientific community hasn't had a chance to delve into an alien planet for a long time. So This is the last great unknown in our solar system.
Well, thanks for the info. Keep us posted on the information about
that. Keep you updated.
That. Thank you very much. Miles, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
I'm going to let you do one news story before we go into discussion about electronic voting. So.
All right. Here, part of my Frankenstein one.
Oh, that's good. Good Halloween one.
Flying by brain. Scientists at the University of Florida have taken rat brain cells.
Yeah, I've done this.
Or rather, extracted 25,000 neurons from a rat's brain and cultured them in a glass dish. The neurons began to extend connections to one another, and actually started making a working neural network.
What were they figuring out? This dish is round.
What they were working out was how to fly a plane.
Why would a rat want to know how to fly a plane? Okay.
They had rat brain cells making like this little rat neural network, basically.
Okay, so you got like some pseudo neural network. How do you
flying
program
a plane
that?
In a simulator?
How do you program a rat neural network?
Well, see, this is why I don't have a PhD in neurobiology.
They had a grid of electrodes that the neural net was spread over, and it was connected to a computer running a flight simulator. How'd they do, did they say? How did the rats do it flying a plane?
Well,
should commercial airline pilots be worried?
Oh, I seriously doubt that. I'm thinking more along the lines of, let's see. If
today
the plane crashes, it sends like something that's like, ow, that hurts, you know? So crashing hurts. Flying normally feels good. Gives like a nice
euphoria.
So
that's what they do. They give some feedback to the system somehow.
I would assume so,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Petri dish 1 is flying the plane today. Well, really cool that they're working on trying to figure out neural networks, biological neural networks. Kind of scary, but neat.
Yeah.
God, you know, that's amazing that rats have that many neurons in their head.
Yeah. Well, Miles, you got another story for us? That was so good. I'll take one more from you.
Yes, there's a waterproof MP3 player being released.
So that you can listen to it?
Water-resistant or waterproof?
Waterproof, as far as I'm aware of. Normally, headphones work because they have an airflow going past them. It's able to... have a small speaker and they're vibrating air. But, of course, when you're underwater, if water gets into the headphones, then that...
stops working as well.
Not to mention if it gets into the electronics of the MP3 player.
You would have more corrosion than anything else.
Okay, so what's the solution?
This one is... they don't have regular earphones. What they have is a speaker that hooks up to the side of your face and sends sound through your cheekbone.
Kind of like the bone phone.
Yes. And so they're able. It's able to work for people who are surfers or swimmers. And
great. So we're going to have surfers with MP3 or music going on.
Yeah, up to 4 hours of play for this.
How great is that? Yeah. Miles? John, thank you very much for the news.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell, the Geeks This Morning, Miles Elam, and John Tracy. Stephen M. Cherry is Senior Associate Editor for IEEE Spectrum Magazine. In this month's issue, I was captivated by his article on electronic voting. Stephen Cherry, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Thank you for joining us today from New York.
My pleasure.
Stephen, first off, I want to get into the whole state of electronic voting, and we'll be doing that. But let me ask you, what do you envision as the end-all, be-all of electronic voting? Is it going to help society? Is there going to be something different electronic voting can bring to us that traditional paper voting can't? What's the need for it?
Well, there are some benefits to electronic voting. One benefit is a quick and, in one sense at least, accurate counting. Another benefit is handicap or disabled access. There are things that you can do with a computer-based voting system that you can't do with traditional paper or optical scan systems. So, for example, you can have voting machines that read to the blind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the benefits of computer technology and network technology are in principle yours with electronic voting.
Mm-hmm.
There is, looking way out into the future, you know, we could imagine secure internet-based voting and completely paperless transactions.
So the idea being possibly in the future that you wouldn't actually go to a polling place, you would just participate in voting.
We can have that hope someday.
Right. Okay. So that's kind of the idea and the push behind it. Now, is there a without those benefits, like if you still provide in personal interaction for people that have handicaps that don't allow them to fill out a paper ballot, and then you also accept that you'll always be polling places, we can accept that maybe the delay of voting for we can't get an accurate count for like 2 weeks. If you take all those exceptions. Is there going to be like a wall that we run into with paper voting where we just can't really process all the paperwork?
I don't think so. Okay. We used paper for hundreds of years, thousands of years. I guess we used little stones or something like that back in the Greek days. But but certainly physical only, non-electronic systems have worked just fine throughout Western civilization. And if we, like the Canadians and plenty of other people, were satisfied to, not know who won even a close election before we went to bed on election night, then we could live with paper forever.
Okay. So with that, then, what we're doing with electronic voting is really adding some benefits we don't necessarily need but are nice.
Right.
That's what we're trying to do. Okay.
That's right.
How are we doing?
Well, let me just... first point out that out of all of the problems that we may see this year and are starting to already see, e-voting is almost the last of our worries, right? Just to put this in perspective.
Good point.
We're seeing, challenges to voter registrations. We've got the felon problem, the absentee ballots, the provisional votes. We have... if you were going to take a pool, on how many jurisdictions there would be challenged ballot counts in the U.S., you know, say by, I don't know, Thursday at noon next week. Personally, I wouldn't even start that pool in less than the five-digit numbers.
Whoa. It's going to be that bad, huh?
It's going to be quite a mess.
Okay.
But leaving all that aside, you know, one thing to worry about is the challenges that we may not see regarding electronic ballots, because one thing about electronic voting, and keep in mind that in the United States, 2004, we will have somewhere between 25 and 30% of all U.S. ballots cast through electronic systems that have no paper record whatsoever.
That's pretty bad.
These systems have the potential to have problems, errors, mistakes, or actual malicious, you know, code and altered results that we have no reason to suspect.
And there is not going to be recounts on these because you can't recount them.
That's right. There will be talk of recounts, and but just like 2000, many of the recounts that were done in 2000 were not actual recounting. They were just a restatement of the previous results. And in the case of electronic voting, really what they do is they just sort of look at the individual machine and take that number again, because there's no way to actually count the votes again. And then what they do is they usually, you know, sort of retally all of the machines, to, you know, up to the precinct level and then all the way up to the county level and, you know, in some cases up to the state level. But these are retallyings or re-addings.
So basically you're just taking the same numbers and saying, yep, here are the numbers again.
Exactly. You know, just like third grade. Okay, we're going to add them going up now instead of down.
Right, right. And from your article I was reading, that this is not necessarily because there's any one group that's trying to do something maliciously. This was a jurisdictional thing having to do with all the different states.
Well, one thing that's interesting about the United States that that we who live here take for granted, but our publication is a worldwide one, that I had to note for our readers, is that the U.S. is almost unique in assigning responsibilities for the conduct of elections to the state and even, you know, more local jurisdictions. So, in other words, constitutionally, this is a state responsibility, and that the states themselves can either do it as a whole at the state level, or they can assign responsibilities to the individual counties or townships or whatever they want. So in some cases, such as Georgia, most things are done statewide, but in other places, such as Florida, most things are done at the county level.
And because of that, there are a lot of decisions being made on which kind of systems to take.
One thing we have is even the jurisdictions that decide to go electronic, there's a wide variety of vendors, and then leaving the newest machines aside, you know, deciding whether to stay with an old system or a new system. Some places can't stay with the very oldest systems. For example, Florida, you know, they you know, were determined to get off of the pure paper, you know, potential butterfly ballot. But there are systems that we've used for several years, optical scan systems, for example, that that have worked just fine. And some people are buying new machines along those lines. And right. Only some jurisdictions are choosing these all-electronic, no-paper-involved machines.
Is Florida doing that a lot? Are they doing a lot of electronic voting this time?
I don't think I actually have a count of how many pure electronic counties there are, but there are some.
All right, and you were talking about this as, for example, California has a required paper audit trail for their voting machines.
Yeah, I want to get the paper trail.
But other states don't have the requirement, so they don't have a need to get, or there's no mandate to get a machine.
Yeah, that requirement doesn't kick in until, I think, 2006, so right. that's not a factor in the 2004 elections. Well, in fact, as far as these newest electronic machines, but with paper added back into them, there will only be a few such machines used in next week's election in Nevada.
Uh-huh. So really, when you talk about that more than 25% no paper trails, it's because all the electronic voting don't have paper trails, basically.
All of the newest electronic, right. I mean, the term electronic is a little ambiguous, so So you might want to consider an optical scan system to be electronic. There are electrons flowing through the system. But but the pure electronic, no paper systems, 25 to 30% this year.
Okay. What's so difficult about making a good... I mean, we've got great ATM machines. No one complains about those, and those things achieve a very similar process. So
we do have great ATM machines, and we have ATM machines, you know, not just, you know, in the sides of banks, but in gas stations and bodegas.
Yeah, I mean, you can rent them. I mean, it's... You can lease
them. They can be just trucked in overnight, just like voting machines. So why can't we use them? In fact, why can't we use the actual ATM system? In fact, the biggest vendor for electronic voting machines is Diebold, and they are the biggest vendor of ATMs, and that's how they got into the voting business in the first place. So what's the problem? The problem is there's a fundamental difference between a voting transaction and a banking transaction, and that difference is when you walk into up to an ATM, you identify yourself for the bank, and the bank acknowledges your identity, and it retains that identification throughout the entire transaction. And that's important because
and
a week later, if you want to dispute the transaction, you know, there needs to be some record that it was you.
Right. And actually,
even indefinitely, that transaction is associated with you. There's never kind of separation of that.
That's right. In voting, it's quite the opposite. You need to identify yourself for the purposes of establishing your eligibility to vote, and the fact that you haven't, you know, voted yet in this particular election. But after that point, which we dissociate your identity from the vote, and that's extremely important because we don't want a week later somebody to be able to roll back the transaction and say, "Aha, we see that you voted for candidate A and not candidate B." And that's really important to avoid coercion or just selling of a vote, which is something that is done in some jurisdictions.
And that's why you can't, like, do a situation where the person gets a paper receipt of exactly what they voted for.
That's right.
That's why when we go in right now with the paper ballots that everyone's familiar with, you get a little stub, but there's no association with that stub. You can't track it back to what you voted for.
That's right. And there's a lot of, you know, technology, and not just technology, but process involved in making sure that, for example, the order of the votes is not maintained, so that we can't say, "Aha, we see from the sign-in sheet that you were the 123rd voter today at that machine, and now let's just look in the back of the machine and see what the 123rd vote was."
Oh, right. So in the system, it's inherently has to protect that sequencing.
That's right.
Which is kind of a problem. I mean, when you're dealing with databases, which we're talking about, you've got to have some kind of index, and normally that's a numerical index that counts up. So you'd be able to look back at the source, if you will, and say, well, the 54th index, that must have been Frank because he came in 54th. So there's a perspective from that. But what else makes the voting system complicated versus an ATM? I mean, I can ask for any allotment of money that I want in 20 increments. I mean, there's still a lot of similarities between them.
Well, that's really the fundamental difference.
That is.
Other than that, I think any other differences could be resolved. But not only is this different from a banking transaction, it's different from pretty much anything else that we do. So it's very hard to take technology from somewhere else and apply it to this problem, and technologists normally solve problems that way. They look around and they see, in a different domain we had some very similar requirements, and so let's figure out some way that's based on that system. We don't really have that with electronic voting because there are very few systems where we actually maintain anonymity. Now, one place that we do that, or thought about doing that at least, is purely anonymous digital cash. About 20 years ago, closer to 25 years ago now, actually, some people saw the rise of online systems and foresaw that a lot of transactions that we would have in the future would be done electronically.
People like David Chum.
People like David Chum, and they noticed that in replacing cash-based transactions, there was one fundamental difference from a social point of view, and that is cash transactions are, relatively speaking, anonymous.
Right.
You go up to a newsstand and you buy a newspaper, and there's an actual face-to-face encounter, but frankly, the newsstand guy isn't likely to remember you, and as anybody who watches Law & Order knows, those identifications aren't, you know, terribly reliable when they when they take place at all. So an electronic purchase typically doesn't have that. Normally, there's this paper trail or electronic trail, tying you to the transaction. But guys like David Chaum, who's a computer scientist and cryptographer, thought that it was important as we build online systems to retain this feature of anonymity. And so he actually designed digital cash systems based on public key cryptography techniques that were just coming into their own in the late 70s, and designed anonymous cash systems. Now, we don't use these very much, unfortunately, because they're more difficult to implement, which means that there, you know, is a higher cost associated with them. And the fact of the matter is, when Americans vote with their, wallets, they choose speed and convenience over anonymity almost every time.
Right.
So, for example, we could have anonymous, highway electronic toll collection, and we don't. We could have a lot more anonymity in many walks of life and choose not to. But he designed these systems, and they are used in some specialized circumstances. And he, a few years ago, turned his attention to the problem of voting, seeing this as a huge area where anonymity was now not just something that maybe people would, pay a few cents extra for, but an absolutely key requirement. And he started working on systems that would be fully electronic, no paper trail at all, and yet retain this key property of anonymity. And he's still working on them. He has sort of a system design, and he's been working on some physical prototypes and so forth. He's actually formed a couple of small companies to try and take this further. And in our magazine article, we actually described his system in some detail. I don't know how much detail we want to get into here because it's extremely
complicated. I would like to try to go metaphorically on it in just a moment, but first, got a little bit of a break. I hope that you stay with us, Stephen. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
Santa Cruz County Elections Department is recruiting citizens to work at the election polls on Election Day, November 2, 2004. Qualified persons are needed to staff the 163 polling places throughout the county. Call Tracy Rosenthal at Santa Cruz County Elections Department at 454-2060.
This is Geek Speak. You're listening to it. We're here. We're talking with Stephen M. Cherry. We're taking your calls now. If you have questions or comments about electronic voting, please feel free to give us a ring. Phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email by going to geekspeak.org and clicking on The Geeks.
This Week in This American Life, a guy who disagrees with President on Iraq, the tax cut, stem cell research, gay marriage, but might vote for him.
Bush has more integrity.
It's weird because you don't notice that you side with the other guy. You're saying, you know what I like about that guy? You know why I'm going to vote for him? He takes stands that I hate.
I know, that sounds crazy, doesn't it?
Undecided voters, we've been following a few for months. This week, they decide.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell, and the air with me are Miles Elam and John Tracy. And we are speaking with Senior Associate Editor for IEEE Spectrum Magazine, Stephen Cherry, about electronic voting. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're welcome to do so by calling 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Stephen, you're right. The Glimmer of Hope segment of your article, the spreadsheet that talks about the cryptography method of David Chaum's, is extremely complicated to some degree. Do you feel like you could try to give it to us in a light way?
I could certainly try. It's probably a lot easier to explain how rat brain cells can fly an airplane than to do this. But
good luck,
take a shot. I will say this also. I mean, even as I worked with Chalmers and a couple of other people, including Rebecca Mercury, another expert on electronic voting and security systems, you know, it's like the glimmer of hope title to this little part of the article was a kind of a private joke for myself, because it's sort of like poetry. There's a glimmer of understanding. You think you have some real insight, and then it just kind of goes away, and you get hungry and can't figure it out anymore. So that said, the key to it is public key cryptography, which involves, two sets of keys. I disclose half of a code. The other half of the code is public. Together, they produce some clear text information, but without both halves, all we have is gobbledygook. That's sort of the key first step in how the system works. So you end up with a receipt which has half of what's needed in order to produce a clear text ballot. And in fact, the entire vote is contained in that half, and that's your receipt. You walk away with it. Because it's encrypted, nobody can look at it and say, oh, I see you voted for, Bush, or I see you voted for Kerry. That's just not possible.
So you have got something that you can't figure out, and the other half of it is something that can't be figured out. So how do you get a vote out of that?
So what happens is, in the voting booth, these two halves can be sort of superimposed on one another. And in an earlier version of his system, he actually physically superimposed them and had these things printed on clear transparencies of the sort that, if you remember, old pre-PowerPoint presentations you would use. And the two transparencies, when laid on top of one another, would produce the clear text vote. And when you separated them, they were just gobbledygook.
Okay.
The current version actually just uses different light sources and projects the two of them one onto the other.
All right. So you can confirm that the two pieces, one of which you're going to take with you, come together to make the vote that you want.
That's right.
Okay.
So you walk away, and in principle, the goal is for you to... a copy of the one that you take, by the way, is kept in the system, an electronic version of that.
Okay,
that's good, because I was just imagining everyone losing their receipts.
Right.
So basically, the system itself keeps something that can show a vote.
It keeps an encrypted version of your vote.
Okay.
And all of those copies, all of our encrypted versions of our votes, can be made available online. So you could actually go later and say, okay, here's the collection of all of the votes in this particular county or state, and here's mine. You can find yours by use of a serial number. And you can see that your vote was recorded by the system exactly as you made it, because you see, oh, there's my name or my serial number and a vote for, Bush or Kerry, but you just look and you can actually match up the patterns. It's these black and white grids, sort of like a checkerboard. You can match up the patterns and say, oh, okay, my vote was recorded accurately because all of the black and white pattern marks are the same in what I'm holding as what I see on screen. Mm-hmm. So you verify that your vote was recorded by the system correctly.
Right.
But you still can't discern what that vote was.
Right.
You verify that your vote's still in the system. It's being counted.
That's right.
Right, okay.
And so, that's the beginning and the end of the system. In the middle is a whole bunch of stuff that basically makes sure that that what we're seeing actually are the ballots that were used in the tallying of the vote on the one hand, and on the other hand, there's a kind of sort of magician reshuffling of the votes under the nutshells to make sure that that vote in clear text cannot be traced back to you.
Miles. I can see that there's some people, I can imagine anyway, that there are some people in the audience that are wondering, well, what good is that if I can't figure out, like, what I had beforehand? And there's a bit of anxiety there. Remember that when you go to the polling place right now, all you get back is a little stub with a serial number on it that has no information whatsoever. So you can't – it's actually giving you more than what you have now.
Right.
I would say that the, you know, the principal obstacles to implementing a system like this are no longer technological. Chalmers has really figured out pretty much how to do something like this. But really, when it comes to voting, only – you know, a small percent of the problem is the physical machine itself.
Right.
In order to design a secure and accurate and trustworthy voting system, there have to be procedures in place involving, you know, poll officials and poll watchers, and, you know, the machines have to be brought into a place and they have to be, you know, physically secure. And all of this stuff has to, and then the votes have to be, you know, counted, and the tallies have to be transmitted accurately and faithfully and completely, and then we tally up everything. And there's just all of these processes involved that have almost nothing to do with the physical machines themselves. And the biggest obstacle for CHAM right now is convincing the public at large and election officials and voting machine manufacturers that this system, you know, makes sense, it's trustworthy, it's accurate, it's complete, and it has all of these other... And not only that, but that it can be implemented by, you know, the little old guys and the little old ladies who are typically the ones who are, you know, handing you
right,
you know, that little chit at the end in the polling precinct. So
okay, Stephen, we've got a whole bunch of calls. I just want to, before I start taking calls, I want to remind people that we are only talking about electronic voting today. We're not going to be answering calls of other nature. So I'm sorry, Stephen from Salinas, we won't be talking about video on a PC. You're welcome to, of course, go to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us, and ask us via email. We'd be happy to help you in that regard. Marty from Santa Cruz, question about electronic voting. Go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, you know, it's like, it's all very well and good, that, you know, the esoteric niceties that he's, your guest is trying to envision for these, you know, the future machine with the encoded receipt and all this stuff. But the problem is, the simple thing that you were talking about before is, you know, Diebold's ability to crank out a receipt that could be left behind. Like, I don't know that we're anonymous now, even though there's no receipt. And yet, I do know that there's no way that the overall vote is accountable. So it's like, it's outrageous that we're using the machines. I mean, from my understanding, in Venezuela, the election they just had, that they had paper receipts on their computer machines. They can do it there, but we can't do it here. It's crazy. I mean, Rush Holtz had a bill before Congress going back all the way to May 22, 2003 that would have demanded a paper trail accountability. And Tom DeLay and the Republicans never allowed it to come to a vote.
Okay. Thank you, Marty, very much for the question. I'm going to have to take you off to get Stephen to respond to it. Stephen, what, if you could.
Well, I think Marty has, you know, hit on all of the key problems with electronic voting. Without paper, we really just don't know what's going on in these machines. There are some things that we could do that would give us a better handle on the situation, but they still really wouldn't provide us with the complete assurance that our vote is going to be, you know, cast correctly and accurately and never be traced back to us. The first thing that could be done would be to open source the code itself.
Okay, well, before we go into open source, that's a great issue. About a paper trail, what's the problem? An ATM machine has been spitting out receipts forever. Why couldn't you just spit out a receipt in a locked cabinet that you can read real quick but you don't take with you? I mean, what?
Why isn't
that happening? No, you don't take the receipt with you. It just goes in the system for – why not?
Yeah, the short answer is there's no really good reason, and the slightly longer answer is that it just adds a little bit of expense and complexity to the systems themselves. I mean –
So there
There's
needs
no
to be
question
policy
that,
in place,
again, we're
basically
relying on the little old ladies and the little old men to, you know, make sure that the paper flow is working and that the printer doesn't jam and all of that stuff. And it's not just a receipt that's going to be spit out and handed to us. Keep in mind that that in a system like the ones that that we actually had an earlier article in October of 2002 that described such a machine, typically the paper is contained behind a glass enclosure, and you simply look at it and say, okay, yes, that that is correct. I voted that way. And then the paper drops down into some secure bin. And
And the reason why
counted
that's not,
either initially or as a recount mechanism.
And the reason that's not happening is that when the electronic voting companies that were producing these products, they weren't required to do it, and it would have added cost and complexity that they felt wouldn't make them as competitive in the market.
That's the fundamental answer.
So really, we need policy in place to really. Cause these systems to be built correctly.
Or like just any
I would point out one other thing.
Yeah,
just a set of requirements.
Right,
and
then be clear.
Go to them.
So Stephen, California's done that for 2006. It's got to have a paper trail, right?
Right.
Okay. So you were about to say?
I was just going to say that some cynical voices out there have suggested that perhaps the voting officials themselves, in some cases, didn't want there to be a paper trail.
Conspiracy theory basis.
Conspiracy or just laziness.
Uh-huh.
In some cases, if you think about it, from the point of view of a voting official, a paperless system is attractive because there just aren't all of these complexities of recounting.
Right. There's not as much work to do in it.
Right.
And that's what they're being sold on when the company comes in and say, look, you know how you have to spend weeks afterwards figuring all that paper stuff out? We're going to remove that completely. It's going to be very easy and reliable. And, of course, from the perspective of, well, I've got a certain workload, my budget's been cut, yeah, okay, let's do that. It makes a lot of sense. And that's why we're in the state we're in.
That's right.
Okay. You talked about open source. I do want to – I'll lead you to that question by saying that concept by saying that, well, okay, there's not a paper trail, but these computers are just machines, and machines can be dissected and looked at to figure out if they're doing it correctly. So therefore, even if you don't have a paper trail, but you see the process the entire way, and a lot of people look at it, then isn't it clear that it would have to spit out something reasonable? The votes have to be counted because logically the process works such that that happens. So
yeah, I think experts would agree with almost everything until the final part of that. And in other words, they would say that an open machine as much as possible is a necessary condition for having trustworthy electronic voting, but it's not a sufficient condition. And let's look at the two parts of those in a little more detail. The problem right now is that the voting machine manufacturers don't want to disclose their code. They consider their code to be part of their value add. They want to be able to say, our machines work better, they have more features and so forth than our competitors, and open sourcing would reduce that. Although, as we know from Linux and other open source examples, it doesn't eliminate the possibility of doing a better job. But leaving that aside, the equipment manufacturers have refused to disclose their code. We could require that their code be disclosed. We don't yet. The reason
Do you think it's important?
I think it's absolutely essential.
Why?
Well, for the reasons that you gave. As we see with operating systems, when you have dozens or hundreds or thousands or millions of eyes looking at code, it's going to be more secure. And when you have people able to work on a little corner of the code and contribute it, it's going to get better. And we've seen that. We can argue all day whether Linux is a better or worse operating system than Windows, but the fundamental fact is Diebold is no Microsoft. And however much we might like to bash Microsoft, they do spend millions of man hours producing millions of lines of code, and Diebold is not doing that. So
you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and John Tracy, and we're speaking with Stephen Cherry, who's the senior associate editor for IEEE Spectrum magazine, a magazine I personally read every month and love. Miles got a question for you, Stephen.
Well, as an open source advocate, I would also say that I would also take the point of view that just because you have more eyes looking at it, like the idea that many eyes make all bugs shallow, that old mantra, is not necessarily true. Someone actually has to make a concerted effort to make a security audit.
Right.
But at the same time, security audits happen with projects that people care about, and I would assume that enough people in the country care about voting that they would come forth and do an audit on it.
And not just the country either. I mean, the core code, is going to be, could be used in Venezuela and India and Brazil and everywhere else in the world that's moving to electronic voting.
Right, and it's funny that you brought up India, among others. India and Australia both had electronic voting, and they both had open code and had a very successful election with electronic voting machines.
Let's get into that in just a second. If you'd like to participate, ask questions similar to what Miles is asking right now. You're welcome to do so. The phone numbers to ask questions about electronic voting of our guest, Stephen Cherry. 866-476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We are taking questions about electronic voting, and all the lines are open right now, except for the one to New York that has Stephen Cherry on it. So, Stephen Cherry, please, yes, what's going on with the other countries that are doing this so well?
Before we turn to those, I just want to turn to the other half of the problem that we were talking about before, and whether that is whether open source is a sufficient condition for safe and secure and accurate elections. And it's not, because for the reasons that we mentioned before, we still need procedures in place to actually use this source code in a way that that we can trust. So it has to be, you know, the code has to be put in the machine in a trustworthy way, and it has to not be tampered with once it's put in the machine, and the machine has to physically get to the precinct. And
the truth of the matter right now, the people that are trustworthy in voting are volunteers that don't necessarily have the skill to program a machine.
That's right.
Okay. So that would be a major problem. Because even if a company's taking on, they have the hardware, and then they open source their software, and then they're installing it in, who's to say they're really doing that?
Right. I mean, you know, the problems can be as simple as, you know, does your machine take 4 hours to boot up? And this was a problem in one jurisdiction in the primary elections this year. And, you know, they learned a hard lesson when they, you know, couldn't have anybody voting for the first couple of hours that the polls were open. Now they know to, you know, get down there at 4 a.m. And start the machines so that they'll be ready at 8 a.m.
That's a lot more convenient.
But so let's get now
the other countries.
Other countries. India had a surprisingly good outcome with a nationwide election this summer that that used all electronic machines with no paper backup. And
how complicated was it compared to our elections?
They had there were some key differences between their elections and ours. For one thing, they used a single machine designed for the entire country, so that certainly was a plus for them. The other thing to keep in mind is that the standards of success in India were a little different from the standards of success here. They had never had elections that moved as quickly as this election did. The electronic machines were quicker than the paper process, not just in the counting later, but just moving people through the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were very happy with an election that, you know, more finicky U.S. citizens might have been less happy with. That said, it was a pretty good election, with the one caveat that it was all electronic, and if there was any chicanery in the code itself,
no one would know.
We wouldn't know.
Now, there's a great picture in your article of a woman voting, a Kashmirian woman voting in that Indian election, and the device looks, I mean, it's just a whole bunch of buttons with lights and words written next to them. It's not like a big touchscreen complicated thing. It's a whole bunch of switches, and you push one of them, and the light lights up, and you know that you voted for the person you want, and then I'm assuming there's a next button.
Right.
So it's really quite a simple system, but it looks like you couldn't really handle the kind of complexity that we handle with a system like that, where there's tons of different initiatives in different sections of the populace.
Yeah, I believe that their machines could handle an election of some complexity, and I would also point out that I just got my sample ballot in the mail the other day, and it's probably simpler than this election they had in India. We just don't have that much going on in New Jersey. Statewide elections were in the odd number of years. But
right. To bring up something with the Indian election, it seems to me it was also they had to support dozens of languages for that.
Which
they
is
did
also
indeed.
The case in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. Well, at least five languages. But
not as much as the
Indian election. Right. There is a lot of language support for the United States. So what about that? How'd they do it?
That I couldn't say, but okay. I believe that the systems themselves, were designed to handle multiple languages in a fairly easy way. Most of these, it is actually one of the big benefits, and actually when we talked about handicapped and disabled access, we should have mentioned multiple languages as well.
Dee Dee from New York sends us an electronic message. Would this be easier during a less critical election?
I think everything would be easier than you know, starting for the first time this year. But luckily, a few of these systems are being introduced in November. Almost any machines that are being used in November were also used in a primary earlier this year.
Okay, I see. So it really, I mean, the inherent problems with the machines are still there.
That's right.
No matter what kind of election it is. Are you planning to be really open for people asking you questions next week? I mean, you'd be all over the press when people are saying, yeah, why can't we do recounts? I mean, I'm assuming it's this election's going to cause, well, you said there's like more than, well, there's like something like 300 or so potential contested areas. And some of those, a quarter of them, are going to be electronic voting. So do you think you'll be explaining this stuff a lot next week?
I think it's hard to say because first of all, we have all of these problems that have nothing to do with the fact that,
right,
that elections are electronic. We have, you know, all of these problems with voter eligibility and long lines and, you know, potential intimidation and all of this stuff that's going on. So that's the first factor. The other factor is when you suspect a problem in one of these electronic non-paper elections, it generally takes a while in order to analyze the data enough for your suspicions to be aroused. So what happens is you typically look and see, it's kind of bizarre that in this jurisdiction, these precincts had, you know, nearly 50-50 voting, and then this precinct over here was, you know, 90-10.
Right.
But it takes you a while to go through the data and see that, or to compare percentages now versus 4 years ago, where you'd say, oh, they probably would be a little different, but they're not going to be radically different.
Right? That's a concern that I have, not so much that a person will get in and hack an individual machine, in which case you'd be able to affect hundreds of votes, but that once the information is collated, that in the code somewhere, it could allow someone to tamper with, you know, say, an entire precinct or an entire state's election voting. Is there any kind of watchdog over that?
Well, I mean, at a certain point of subtlety, you just don't know, and it's hard to even be suspicious. And that's the biggest fear with these paperless, all-electronic machines. So in other words, you know, we would consider, you know, a 56-44 split to be a landslide victory for the winner. But all it takes is manipulating a few percentage points to, you know, take something that's 50-50 into 56-44. And that's just to turn something into a landslide. If you're concerned that your candidate is going to lose by a half of a percent, and, you know, there's how many states are going to be decided by, you know, 1% or less next week, to turn every hundredth vote for candidate X into a vote for candidate Y is not that hard to do in code, and it would be undetectable when all you're doing is analyzing data or exit polls or anything like that.
That raises a question for me that goes away from the technical side of it. Uh-huh. Like me myself, I look at an equation and I trust it. I have a trust in mathematics. This is not the same as statistics. I mean, it's having something that's just a straight raw equation, which is much more of what computer software tends to be, is an equation. I wonder, how do we get past not the technical aspects, but the trust issues? How do we get the populace? Because that's another aspect of elections that's
just
very important.
Just because us geeks understand a computer really clearly and we feel a certain trust about it, what about everybody?
Right.
Everybody,
so, for example, that cryptography on there, I trust the math behind that.
Behind the cryptography solution.
Yes. Uh-huh. But how do you instill that trust in the general populace that doesn't have even a cursory understanding of how cryptography works?
Stephen?
Well, I think that's, first of all, it's the fundamental challenge that lies ahead for any really good, technically correct solution to the electronic voting problem. The problem is one of process and then trust and assurance. I'd say that's true of everything in our, you know, modern electronic age. I mean, we all remember the stories from, you know, years ago, the earlier, you know, mostly mainframe-based systems where, you know, you'd get a phone bill, or somebody would get a phone bill somewhere for, you know, $10,000 or something for, you know, or they'd look in their bank account and see that they had suddenly, you know, $90,000 richer. it's not like the machines didn't add things up correctly. It's that they weren't told exactly what to do in every possible case. Mm-hmm. And in principle, that's no different today in both designing the system to account for every possible case and then assuring people, yes, we have accounted for every possible case.
Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Our geeks are today were Miles Elam and John Tracy. And our guest, Stephen M. Cherry, as Senior Associate Editor for IEEE Spectrum Magazine, covers the Internet and intellectual property and related issues in telecommunications, networking, computing, and public policy. He also oversees editorial content for Spectrum Online, which, of course, is their online version, which you can get to by going to www.spectrum.ieee.org. Stephen M. Cherry, thank you very much for being here today on Geek Speak with us.
My pleasure.
Did you have any closing additions to what you wanted to say today?
The one thing that we have in our control is to get out there and make sure that our vote was cast.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for joining us on Geek Speak today.
Thank you.
The Geeks, Miles Elam is a Java programmer and web developer and student of American literature. John Tracy is owner and operator of FeltonGames.com. Geeks, I thank you very much for being here every week on Geek Speak.
I'm still voting with the paper and pen.
You are?
I am.
What about you, Miles? You happy with paper and pen?
I'm
going to
be voting with paper and pen, but that's just because my district does that.
Thanks, Geeks. And Maggie, thank you for producing. To all of you that called in and listened to Geek Speak, thank you for making Geek Speak what it is. Without your input, it'd just be us geeking out. Who wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, and KDBH San Ardo. We're on the web at kusp.org. Coming up right next, right after a quick NPR break, is The Open Road, followed by Charlie Ling's wonderful show, Two Steps and the Blues. Stay tuned. Great day to listen to KUSP. Next week, Geek Speak will be back at its normal time, as it is every week, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. Thank you very much for participating in Geek Speak. And here's NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Democratic presidential contender John Kerry is delivering today what his camp is calling his closing argument of the campaign before a weekend of get-out-the-vote rallies. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Senator Kerry offered an audience in Orlando, Florida this morning a summary of his plans to change America, from the way it conducts the war in Iraq to policies on science, energy, and the economy.
Wake up! The middle class of America is paying a higher tax burden as a share of the tax burden under George Bush and lower wages, and the millionaire